This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
Thank you for downloading episode number 37 of the Retro Asylum podcast. My name is Matt Dinaris, and I'm going to be taking you through with an interview of a bit of a retro gaming legend. Before I launch into that, I'd like to thank our site and podcast sponsors for this time round: Anthony Ogden, Mr. Sid, and Foggy. Thank you very much. It's your money and donations that help keep this thing running. If you want to donate some spare cash you've got lying around, or you've just got so much money you don't know what to do with it, get over to www.retroasylum.com, click the donate button, and any donations are much appreciated. It's what helps keep this site and keep the podcast running. So I record an interview with one of my gaming legends, because I've played his games just so much over the years, and specifically one of his later games. And it was an honour to interview him, a real honour, and just to basically chew the cud with him for a few hours. It turned out to be a very, very long interview, so I hope you enjoy it. Now, what I will say first and foremost, it does get a little bit techie, so if you've not got your maths hat on, you've not got your geek shoes brushed up and polished, make sure you do before you have a listen to this. We get quite in depth at times, and it's not so much of an interview rather than a chat. It's more of a chat. I'm not just throwing questions at him and expecting answers. We got into some quite in depth and sort of diverted off the subject quite a number of times. So onwards and upwards, Retro Asylum podcast episode number 37. This is the Dino Dinny interview, and this is part one of two, because we went on for so long I've chopped it up into two for you. Enjoy. Okay, welcome along to the Retro Asylum podcast. This time we are lucky enough to be joined by Dino Dinny for an interview. To set the scene for you, Dino is most known for, forgive the pun, kicking the football game genre out of the, what I would call, the foot stuck to the ball style of gameplay into a genre that essentially the physics mimicked the real game. Guess our best yardstick before kickoff come about was maybe Microprose Soccer, which introduced the concept of a bending shot, but I think it was done very tongue-in-cheek, and it was known as a banana kick, and it was essentially quite ridiculous. Then Dino come along, kickoff come about, and we entered, I would say, probably the world of physics in football game. Would you see it that way, Dino?
I think that's fair, yeah. The first thing I started when I did the development, the first things I started with were the pitch. That's how my mind works. I need a football pitch. So I did that, the scrolling background, and then I say, well, next I need a ball. And then I spent some time just working on, you know, the ball motion, and it's based on, you know, very simple physics, you know, very simple. But I did also include air friction. Mm-hmm. And that was a decision right at the very beginning, and, okay, and I did that because I said, well, there is such a thing as air friction. It turned out to be a good call.
Yeah. So that was introduced to the concept of wind, essentially.
Once I'd actually had air friction, then I said, oh, well, you know, I can add wind with, like, you know, three lines of code or something. So it became trivial to add the wind effect.
Let's come right back before kickoff. I've done my research this. I know a lot about you anyway. I can't find anything about pre-kickoff. But was there a Dino Dinny in gaming before kickoff?
Yeah, I actually started making games some 10 years before I started work on kickoff. Mm-hmm. In common with many people of my era, when we were kids, the home computers first started to come out.
Yeah.
So the first computer that I owned was that was bought for me by my parents was an Acorn System 1.
Blimey, yeah.
And you can find that on Wikipedia and so on, but it's basically a 16 key keypad, hex keypad basically, mm-hmm, and a calculator display, and that was it. It's really a kind of more like what we would call today a microcontroller card,
yeah,
you know, whatever. But I because I had been exposed to some video games and especially pinball when I was very young, I had this kind of idea of making machines that were games. And so I actually made some games on that. Mm-hmm. But from there, I moved on to other home computers. And so I actually did have some published games before before Kickoff, but they're not very well known. They come from a kind of the 8-bit era.
Yes.
So really, I made a name for myself in the 16-bit era.
Yeah. So what platforms were those games for? Was it on this Acorn System 1, or was it, you know, the more traditional Spectrum, Commodore, Amstrad?
Well, there were different camps and arguments at school about, you know, which systems were the best. And basically, there were two camps at that time. There were the BBC Micro people, who perhaps had come via the Acorn route. And then there was always the Sinclair guys, you know, so the ones that had gone by the ZX 8081 and then the Sinclair Spectrum. And so the ones that I worked through was, like, after System 1, there was the Acorn Atom.
Yes.
Which was absolutely brilliant for the time. It was, words cannot express how brilliant it was, because it did have a BASIC machine in there, but their version of BASIC supported inline assembler. So this was really, really cool for the time. It was actually pretty much, I think it was ahead of its time.
Yeah, so that was essentially, when you were running it, that was compiling the BASIC into assembler, as well as allowing the assembler just to be in there as well.
I don't think it was doing compiling of the BASIC.
Okay.
It was still interpreted. Well, it's tokenized BASIC, so it would, you know, it would tokenize the text, the keywords, obviously. Mm-hmm. But what it had was an inline assembler, so that you could write a 6502 assembler inside your BASIC code. And just to put that in perspective, people on the ZX8081 and so on, maybe I never programmed those machines, so I'm not sure about the Spectrum. But you could program in assembler, but you had to peek and poke bytes.
Yes.
So it was a peek instruction, poke instruction. You had to create any assembler routines. Whereas on the Acorn Atom, it actually came with built-in assembler. And that was very, very important. And
quite unique, actually, because I don't even think the Commodore 64 allowed that.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the other thing was about the BASICs is that most of the home computers at the time all used Microsoft BASIC, I believe.
Yes, they did, Certainly the Commodore one was,
And the same thing with all the Commodore. The Commodore PET, I was going to say, but obviously that was also a Commodore. But the Acorn guys, the Acorn company, who still kind of go. They're the origin of the ARM, Acorn RISC machines.
So yeah, we spoke about that in a podcast just a few weeks ago. Actually, we're talking about the Archimedes and the ARM. Yeah. We spoke about the ARM chip quite in depth, actually.
I think one of the regrets I have is that I never got my hands on an Archimedes, because at the time that was really cool.
It was, and that's what we were saying. I got a love for them from school.
Anyway, after the Acorn Atom, which was very good, I got a BBC Micro, obviously, because I stuck with loyalty towards Acorn. And so the first actual games that I got published were for something called the Acorn Atom Magic Book.
Right.
This goes back a very, very long way, about 1980-ish. Those were the first games that I ever had published. And that was in the book that you had to type them in.
Yeah.
Right. Then after that, with the BBC Micro, there was the BBC user club called B-Bug.
Right.
And I did an Asteroids clone for that. And so that was published. And I actually made, you know, some good amount of money at the time.
Excellent.
Probably both of those together for a kid, but it was about £2,000 back then. And so that was, all right for a kid.
Absolutely. Yeah. Not a menial sum at all.
And then I went to university. So there was a kind of a bit of a break there. Mm-hmm. And then I came back and I was working repairing ST computers at a company called the Silica Shop in.
Remember it well, yeah.
In Sidcup, which wasn't too far away from where I lived. And I said, you know, I want to get back to doing games. And so it was from that point then that I did a game called Trivia Trove, which is just like a tiny conversion of a tiny game.
Right.
But it proved that I could do the job to Anko at the time. And then they said, it was Anil Gupta. He said, I think I would like a football game.
Yeah, okay.
So then the whole thing went from there.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, you know, what was the attraction of football games? And it sounds very much like Anko was the push for that.
Well, Anko was a very small publisher, and it wasn't really doing top-notch games, but they were local. They were not too far away from where I lived, basically. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know where to go, so I went to them. And that was just the idea that that Anil had. I think he'd been looking at other football games, and he'd said, you know, that they don't really look like football. So he said, you know, I'd like a football game that's more like actually what football is.
Yeah.
I wanted to just get back into doing games.
Yes.
Even the idea of doing a football game at first, I thought, well, you know, football game. Hmm. Then I thought, okay, I'll go away, do a little sort of feasibility study. You know, I made a demo. I needed to know whether the Atari ST, because that's the computer I owned.
Okay. And
so the question was, you know, was the Atari ST able to render the graphics I needed? I devised some rendering routines for the sprites written in assembler, obviously, and then I had to figure out how to make a pitch. And I said I need the right dimensions, because when I was looking at other football games, they were just very silly. You would have these big sprites, they were often side on, they would have these big sprites on tiny soccer fields that looked even smaller than a five-a-side.
Yeah, international soccer on the Commodore 64 is one that always sticks in my mind. There's, like you say, massive sprites and a pitch that was side on with a sort of perspective to it, and it just didn't. Well, it obviously worked at the time, but looking back on it now, it's hideously primitive, isn't it?
Well, it's okay. It was like an interpretation of football, and I guess you know, it's part born as well from the constraints of the system. You can't. And that's what's really interesting about design is, you know, if you want to have, if you try to make a full-size football pitch so that you can actually see the sprites, you know, that they're a reasonable size.
Yes.
You've got something has to give, because football pitches are big. They're huge.
Mm, mm.
So, you know, and so obviously if on the Commodore 64, they weren't able to render a really huge scrolling background. And I never programmed the Commodore 64, so I'm not familiar with the possibilities and constraints of that system. Mm-hmm. But that's what you have to wrestle with. If they were to scale that pitch up with the size of the sprites on the screen that they used, the pitch would be massive. Absolutely huge, and they probably couldn't do it. And it's funny, because it was in an Acorn user exhibition many years ago. There was a game that was being played at the exhibition, which was a version of Asteroids. I played this game, and I loved Asteroids. I tried playing this game, and I hated this version of the game. And the reason was because the sprite for the ship was too big. Mm. It's like, you know, this thing about bigger is better that seems to affect everything in this day and age, even music. You know,
absolutely.
Got to be loud. Everything has to be always loud. The point is that it's like, okay, don't you see, a designer of this game, I thought to myself, if you make the ship that big, you're making the world tiny. Mm. And so the end effect that you get is this claustrophobia. And it's funny, it's just seeing that always stuck in my mind. So when I came to making the decisions for Kickoff, I said, you know, I remembered this. I said, the most important thing to remember with these games is the scale. Yeah. It's very important. The way you choose the scale has a fundamental effect on the gameplay. So, I mean, you know, and these days, because I teach video game programming, yep. And I don't teach design at the moment, but I teach the programming, and we have a design department, and they're always there sort of teaching design and so on. And when we're doing game lab, you know, the question of scale always comes up. But I just think back to this and say, well, okay, I had this insight, and it was a very important one, because without it, the Kickoff would never have been what it was, because I said, okay, I need to have the pitch the right size compared to the player.
Yeah.
So I went, how big is a football pitch? So I went, found out. I said, oh my God, that is huge. How am I going to do that? And then I said, okay, now how big do I need the sprites to be? And in part, that's decided by the bus width. So I think it was 16 pixels.
Right.
Gotcha. Width is a natural size. Mm-hmm. If you go to 17 pixels, then you're actually, you know, 20-50% slower in drawing the thing and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I understand.
So so that's how the scale was set. It's as simple as that. But then, of course, that meant that the camera would have to be zoomed in the way that it is, because once you set the size of the soccer field and you set the size of the players, there's no give there. You've got to have the camera zoomed in, and that's how that was formed in this feasibility study, to get back to where we were from.
So this
feasibility study,
it's quite interesting, because it's something that, as a non-programmer like myself, I've dabbled in it, but it's not something that ever crossed my mind, of the way of how did you choose that perspective. And you've just explained now there was very good reasons why that perspective and that scale was chosen. So it's interesting to hear the mindset behind that. Were you daunted by the whole football thing? Are you a football fan in the first instance, or is it a complete alien world to you?
No, I mean, you know, I was geek as a kid. If the name, I don't even know if that term existed back then. Mm. I was not into sports. I was into technology. And, you know, from an early age, I was doing electronics and stuff like that. Yeah. So that whole thing just never really particularly interested me. I used to watch the international football, and I'd enjoy doing that. But I'm on record as saying I'm not a football fan. And it's, but what does interest me is games.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, you don't have to be passionate about a particular topic to be passionate about recreating it.
Well, I think there's an argument that if you're not that ingrained into it, you can actually do a better job, because you're distanced from it and you can see it from a more logical perspective. I think if you've got an emotional involvement in something, it turns out to be very emotional in the way you conceive it, I suppose.
I think there's a truth to that, and I tend to isolate myself a bit from too much information. It's not a kind of a popular view, but I found it works for me. So if I am actually trying to tackle a design problem concerning a particular field, I want to understand the big picture, but I don't want to know about the detail, at least at first.
Yeah, and I think the detail nowadays is so easy to come by, and it's easy to get almost brainwashed by, like you say, too much information on a particular subject, isn't it? Especially the information we've got on the internet these days.
Yeah, I think that's very true. It's difficult to get the big picture. Actually, that's a very interesting point. I think I might at some point go and see how easy it is or difficult it is to actually get big picture coverage of issues.
Hmm.
You can see it with things like the subject of design, though. Because I watched and enjoyed football games, I'd seen enough football and also played football at school, though not very well, to understand the flavour of it. So what you want to do is create a video game that sort of tastes and smells like football, but that's all that matters. So if it tastes and smells like football, but it's really fast, and like a pinball game, which was one of the criticisms of my games or whatever, you know, okay, it doesn't matter if it also has some other attributes which maybe are not realistic. As long as it has the smell, if you like, of football.
Definitely. And it's interesting you should mention pinball there, because, I mean, you mentioned pinball earlier on as well. We've often likened Gold as a bit of a pinball game, because you're just end-to-end the whole time. And it's frantic. It's frantic. It keeps your reactions up, I can tell you. As you get older in life, games like that really keep your reactions going, I think.
But one of the things I found as I continued the development, which is kind of was interesting, is that if I actually made the football player run at the right speed on that big pitch, it was just so slow. Because real football games, the players actually don't move very fast, and the action is actually quite slow.
Mm.
So, in fact, kickoff, the players run about 3 times the real speed.
Yeah.
So you have to choose which constraints are important and which aren't. And that's really the art of design, I think. Yeah.
I suppose you're seeing that realised now in the FIFA-style games, aren't you? Because they're much more about the tactics, and they're more sedate pace. From my experience with them, I've not really played them much. They frustrate me massively. But they're a lot slower.
I really don't get on well with them. And then I those games, I also know, not that I played them at all in the past years, but, you know, many years ago I did to just see what they were like.
Yeah.
And the main problem with them is that everything has gone down this route of realism,
yes,
which is, I would say, one of the biggest mistakes of the AAA video game industry. It drives me nuts.
Because, yeah, I agree.
You know, it's realism doesn't make for fun. So you make a football game, you want to make it look real, so you get real animations, mm-hmm, like motion captured animations. But then as soon as you do that with actual models of people that look like real football players, you can't make them run at 3 times normal speed.
It would look a bit ridiculous, wouldn't it? And also, when you come to that realism, while it from a distance looks real, our mind still perceives it as not real. So, you know, a lighting effect that's slightly incorrect, or when you see a player's face close up and they're lacking that emotion that we have as a human being, it looks wrong. So it's almost that they're realistic to a degree, but we're still nowhere near realism in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can never get there.
No.
And if you could, why do you want to? It's like, you might as well go play football.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, that's the way you could do it. You know, with you actually feel the ball when you kick it.
Yes.
You know, kind of gives you a kick back, you know, and it's a 3D, actual real 3D, like, you know, that with this marvelous technology that the 3D changes its perspective as you move your head, you know. Wow. I just don't really get that. And I think that perspective is being proved correct, that it doesn't matter. I don't know about you. I mean, you obviously, you're a gamer, you play a lot of games. Absolutely, and so on, yeah. But you know, you also switch, I imagine, between, you know, games of the past and games of the present.
Absolutely.
So, do you ever play what's that game, a Magic Carpet?
Do you know what? I never played it, and I saw all the previews of it when it was supposed to be coming out on the Amiga 1200, and it never did. And there was all this, you know, the cancellation sort of press releases. But no, I never played it in the end. But at the time, it looked very realistic, but it was the best that could be done at the time, wasn't it, really?
It was actually quite... I still think it's quite a remarkable game, and I sometimes wonder why Peter Molyneux doesn't make more of it, because the game... I've been playing it... I was playing it a few weeks ago, on an emulator, right? On
DOSBox. PC.
DOSBox, DOSBox. And really a great deal of fun. Now, thing is, it's not very high resolution.
Mm.
Although, of course, you can play it on the high res mode without any problem now.
Okay.
But even there, the graphics are not great. You know, they're good for the time, but compared to today, it's pretty poor. But who cares? Because... Yeah. I don't see it. Does that happen to you? I don't see it anymore. If I start playing a game like that, the poor graphics might annoy me for the first like 5 minutes or a few minutes, but then I'm playing the game, and then I don't even see the pixels anymore.
No, and I think that's one of the whole points of retro game, isn't it, really? And because 2D's come very much in vogue again, you know, over the past few years, I think retro gaming, certainly the 2D, is very relevant now. But like you say, when you get engrossed into a game, it doesn't really matter what the graphics are like. I'm a big driving sim fan, so I do play driving sim games on the more modern platforms. But going back to, say, 96, when Grand Prix 3 first come out, Jeff Crammond's Grand Prix 3, you play it now, and the graphics are good enough to still... be relevant and work now, because the game around it is so fantastic, you know. And that's pretty much what you're saying with Magic Carpet. I can't relate to Magic Carpet because I've never played it, but I know exactly where you're coming from.
I give it a go, because it's actually it's also, in terms of the evolution of games, it's quite interesting, because it's a hybrid of different kinds of games in one. It's like, it's a kind of a mix between a first person shooter and something else. It's a first-person shooter with magic, but at the same time, it's got a kind of a strategy to it, like a real-time strategy game.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Peter Molyneux was always trying to do the sort of god game, wasn't he? Still is trying to do the god game.
Yeah, you can see that there is some influence that, you know, with other games from this. Yeah. But in itself, this isn't that one isn't a God game.
So we've gone right off track there. Let's bring it right back to kickoff. Anko wanted you to write a football game. You went away and started preparing to write it. So if we come on to when it was released from that conception of kickoff, was it everything you expected it to be, or was there the typical time pressures, time constraints that it ended up being a slight compromise? I expect all game development is a compromise at the end of the day.
It really didn't happen that way. I've been trying to understand that aspect of the whole story of my life story for years, and I still haven't got my head around it. When you asked me that question, something popped into my head, which was, and I'm just going to say it, I haven't judged it, and I haven't kind of not editing it, and I don't even, not even sure entirely what it means, but since it's what came into my head, I'll say it.
Yeah.
So it was that I felt what I was doing was brilliant,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't know it.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Is that kind of what...
Yeah.
Does that make sense? And I was in a much better position when I had the feeling but not the knowledge.
Yeah.
This is entirely new, by the way. I've never had this train of thought before, so it's coming out right now. I guess what I'm saying is that it was a surprise, the success that it had.
Yeah.
On one way, it was. Yeah. And in another way, it wasn't.
Another way, you kind of expected it, maybe.
Well, I kind of felt it.
Mm.
But then maybe that is what hope is. So we all hope. It's one of those really difficult things. It's like, maybe I would have had the same feeling if it hadn't been a success, but because it was a success, then it makes that feeling real. And so later you look back at it and you say, oh, well, I knew it was going to. But it wasn't even a case of knowing. It's just I was very confident in what I was doing, I guess is what I'm saying. But not confident that it would be a big success or what that would mean. That didn't enter into the equation. I'll tell you what was really crucial was there was no editorial interference whatsoever. That Anko did not interfere with my design. That has probably since the time that I left Anko, that I've never had that again. There has always been interference with the design. That there's something in there that's it's kind of related to your question. It's a difficult question to answer because I don't know. So did it come out? Did it match my expectations? Did it exceed my expectations? Certainly the, you know, effect that it had on the market exceeded any expectations that I could possibly have had. Mm-hmm. That's clear.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're talking about the game design, I just made a game and I shipped it and it was what it was.
Well, I assume it was commercially successful as well. It wasn't just, you know, critically successful. It was commercially successful.
I mean, it was commercially successful for Anko without any doubt. And the first version of the game was not done for with any kind of royalty deal.
Okay.
So it was actually Anko acquired it sort of fairly cheaply.
Okay.
You know, so then that was different for Kickoff 2 and so on. So I was never really privy to the actual sales figures of the original Kickoff, but it was like top of the charts for quite some time, or at least number one or number two. It was sort of right up there, you know.
Yeah
I think. And then from the critical one, I mean, I remember the first review I saw of it was scathing.
What magazine was that?
I've been trying to to bring back all of these with their archives online now, thank God, so I can prove things like, you know, I actually won a Golden Joystick Award.
Yes, I've got. I've seen that.
I found the proof of that, so you know that's good, because otherwise people don't believe me. You know,
I was going to ask, what was there a prize? Did you get a golden joystick, or was it just a certificate proudly mounted on the wall?
I don't know. I mean, the problem was there's also Anko were kind of between me and it as well, so it was kind of, I don't know if there was prize money. I really don't think there was. There were trophies, but. That's a long story. They all ended up back at Anko. So I actually don't have any of that anymore. I won, I think, Game of the Year. It was probably Arcade Game of the Year. I detailed exactly what it was called somewhere. 2 years in a row. There was one for Kickoff and then for Kickoff 2.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's pretty, that was pretty astounding. I could not have possibly you know, assumed that that was what was going to happen.
No.
But the first review that came out was pretty scathing, mainly because of the graphics.
Yeah, well, right? As I've looked back on those reviews as well, mainly from Amiga magazines, yeah, the graphics were sort of clearly marked as the average part of it.
They were worse than average. I didn't like them at all either. They were improved a little bit for Kickoff 2.
Were they your graphics, or was it Steve Screech that did the graphics?
The original graphics were done a guy that we called Indy. I have no idea who he actually, what is any more information than that. That's all I remember. We called him Indy. And he worked for Anko, and he did the original graphics. Then Steve Screech took the original graphics and then reworked them. That was the weird thing. That magazine that published that review the month after retracted it and did and changed their mind.
Blimey.
Which is kind of unheard of.
It is, unless there was, unless there was a backhander. You know, you hear the magazine stories of being paid money to give a good review. So I obviously don't think that was the case there. But
no, I don't think so. These days, if that ever happened, which is unthinkable, no one ever goes back and changes their mind. It was lucky. I was lucky. It went viral. That's why you can say it. It went viral among the staff of game magazines.
Mm, yeah,
they absolutely loved the game. And then they told everybody how great the game was, and then the game sold, and that was it. So that was cool.
I mean, it absolutely was successful. How did you take that success? Because obviously you were quite young at the time, and I remember reading a blog post that you put up quite recently about the young Dino. How did you take that fame and fortune of Kickoff 1 and Kickoff 2? Was it... You mentioned you were very confident about your abilities and sort of the overall product, but did it go to your head? Or were you quite level-headed about it all?
I'm quite level-headed guy when it came to that kind of stuff. I mean, it did not... too much, maybe.
Mm.
I mean, there are some characters in the industry, they go around, they've got some charisma, they're cocky... They manage to work things with some kind of magical power that's totally beyond me, because I'm not like that. I mean, I can be charismatic, but I'm not charismatic in that way. You know, I'm not a salesman, basically.
No,
it didn't get to my head, but I was young, and it was like 23, and I was in some ways quite cocky. Social skills not really that well developed.
Okay.
Which actually just goes back to my school days, because I was always an outsider, you know, I was bullied as well and stuff. And I never really meshed with other.
Mm-hmm.
I blogged about this too, is that, you know, wanting recognition for my achievements. This is not actually necessarily a very good mix. And being young, and I don't think I really reacted to it very well, to be honest.
I think as youngsters, we've got no idea how to handle stuff like that. I think the majority of us want to be successful in something in life, and if we get that success, it's maybe not go to our head, but we might either get cocky or we wouldn't know how to handle it. There's very few people that could sit back and really say they don't want that success. Obviously, there's one person that popped into my mind quite a lot is Jeff Mint, who's utterly humble and doesn't want to promote his own stuff, but the majority of people do, and that's not to disrespect Jeff Mint at all, because he's an amazing talent, and I know you share that opinion as well from seeing it. But
a nice guy as well.
Absolutely.
I met him for the first time around the summer, and we got on very well. He doesn't seem to want that, but on the other hand, I know, because he's an artist, he does want people to play his games.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what we want.
I think he's very much of the opinion he wants his product to do the talking. It's as simple as that, I think.
I think so, but I guess he's really, even as you say, he's so humble
that
he really puts his entire faith in his game being able to sell. And I actually do relate to that, but kind of learned as well that, well, maybe he's right, and this is, I don't know, he's right.
This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
So coming back to Kickoff 2, it was, and it still is, massively and fondly recognised as one of the best football games ever. There's the Kickoff World Cup that still goes on. Kickoff 2 World Cup that still goes on, played by many people around the world. Was it a tweak of the original code? Was it a complete rewrite? Was it, and was it you that wanted that game, or was it Anko that pushed for that game?
Well, after Kickoff, then there was the question of what to do next, and I was still in that naive zone, I guess. I just looked at the design and I said, there's something that bothers me. And the thing that bothered me was that it was not possible to direct the shots, because the original Kickoff, you could only have eight directions. And it's quite ironic when I say this, I remember this as being the key design feature for Kickoff 2, and it was turned off by default.
Okay.
And he kind of remembered that, like when I went to a retro event a few months back. Mm. And I played the game, and I hadn't played it for years, and there's a story for behind that too. Well, you've seen it in my blog. And I was like, well, where's the aftertouch? And it was because it's by default not turned on. It's ironic. But where the aftertouch came from was this thought that I had. And I actually remember I was with Anil Gupta at a pub somewhere. We were having a pub lunch or whatever. And I was talking, and I was thinking about this, and suddenly I said, I've got the answer. I know how to solve that problem. I was talking to him about the problem. I know how to solve the problem. And what I do is I check the joystick after the kick, and just to have that able to influence the ball.
Yeah.
Right. And so I implemented it, and it worked. And the actual thing about that is the purpose of this wasn't really to swerve the ball, more as it was to try and give more control over the choice of direction.
Okay.
But then obviously it looked really cool with the swerve, so it kind of does both.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, I'm not a massive football fan either, but the whole curved shot up until the point of Kickoff 2 wasn't really big in the game. You know, it was around about 94 with David Beckham, I think, that the curved shot really become famous. And I remember Adidas made the Predator football shoes, football trainers,
yeah,
they call them, with rubber around the toes on one side, so you had better ability to curve that ball. So maybe indirectly Kickoff 2 influenced the real world of football, we could say.
Well, that would be interesting. I mean, I've never in a million years ever thought about that, because they were curling balls before.
Absolutely.
But I suppose David Beckham really did. So was that film, wasn't there? Bend It Like Beckham.
Yes.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought.
It's twisting on his head a little bit, obviously, but yeah. And then we had Kickoff 2, was it Extra Time and the World Cup editions? They sort of feel like sales targets.
Yeah, it's kind of milking it a little bit, and on a certain level, there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely.
I did try though to make sure that they had actual real gameplay features added. It weren't just like it is now. It's the same game that you've had for the last 10 years, ladies and gentlemen, but it's got this year's players on it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that. I mean, so, you know, it's difficult to remember now the actual thing. I seem to remember a weird version of the game where you could actually control the power of the shots.
Okay.
And I cannot for the life of me pin down which version this was.
No, I don't remember that one at all.
It might have been a prototype and I took it off, but there was a version where the timing, like how long after you touch the ball while dribbling that you actually shot the ball,
okay,
would have an effect upon how hard the ball was kicked.
That's interesting, actually.
And I don't know if they ever made it, but I do remember doing it. So it's all got a bit blurry, but there was one where there was like the referee and linesman, which I think was Final Whistle.
Yes, I remember
that. That's cosmetic. So I think towards the end, the Final Whistle was a later one. So towards the end, I think maybe the changes were getting a bit cosmetic. Yes, but then at that point, that's why I went for a complete rewrite.
Yeah.
And so that's where Goal, which was going to be Kickoff 3, came from.
Yeah.
And that was conscious. I mean, because I said, you know, in some ways I was making the right choices back then. I said, well, you know, can't just keep milking the same thing. We've got to move on to the next thing.
Yeah. So you coded first on the ST and ported over to the Amiga, is that correct? And was there a specific development environment there? I mean, because I remember using very briefly DevPack on the Amiga. I don't know what there was on the ST as well. Was it really easy to port them over? Was there any specific hardware tricks you used on the Amiga to maybe help it along a little bit? I don't know the distinct differences between the ST and the Amiga, but was the Amiga hardware used more at all?
Oh, of course it was, absolutely. Because there was no way to make the game run at 60 frames per second, 50 frames per second, without using the Amiga hardware.
Okay.
For the Amiga. I mean, there's it's all the different platforms are slightly different, but the main problem on the Atari ST was that there was no hardware scrolling.
Yeah, it was all done CPU, wasn't it?
Yeah, but the point about hardware scrolling was that you can, it's a really simple thing, but basically when you display an image on the screen, that image is held in memory. So, that's obvious, okay. And then to change things on the screen, you change the memory. But what you can do is have a register that specifies where that memory starts. And on computers that simply had that very easy to do thing, you had hardware scrolling. And that meant that you could have an image and just by changing a register, you'd move the whole image across the screen.
Right, okay.
And so the original ST did not have that. And so it meant that I had to draw the pitch with vertical and horizontal lines because they had to be redrawn every frame. And the background, I cheated by using color switching on the vertical blank. So basically, as the PicTV picture is being drawn, it's just on the fly switching the colors. So this way, I got some kind of grass, mown grass effect.
Yes.
It's really very, very cheesy. And it's the reason why on the ST version, there is no center circle. There are no penalty circles because it was too expensive to draw a circle.
Yeah, okay.
It's all made of horizontal and vertical lines. Really, really crude. But that way I was able to keep the speed fast. On the Amiga, however, it had all kinds of graphic hardware support. Mm-hmm. So two 3-bit planes. And so I used one for the... So I designed it really around the graphic system or exactly around the hardware. So I made the pitch is an 8-color background that scrolls because it has hardware scrolling. Mm-hmm. But then there needs to be a tiling system. So as one edge of the screen scrolls off, it appears on the other. So then it has to, behind the scenes, replace that with the next strip and so on. So you get that. And then the front bit plane was where the sprites were drawn, and they were drawn using the blitter, which is and the Atari ST drawing the sprites had to be done by the CPU.
Yes.
But there was hardware acceleration on the Amiga, so I used that. And that's the main part of it. And then I even used the sprites.
The hardware sprites, yes.
The hardware sprites, but they were used for a very specific thing. But at the bottom, there was this thing on the bottom goal overhangs the pitch. And so it would mean that a football player, like the goalkeeper, if it was on that position there, would look like it was over the goal.
Yes, yes.
Right? So I used the sprites to cover that goal so that they were overlaid over the top of the sprite so that the football player actually appeared to be, you know, behind the goal and not in front of... Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Because on goal, that wasn't the case, was it? It was the goalie was over the goal.
I think on goal, I basically said, who cares? And there was some other technical reason as well. I think because I had pitch scaling in there and different pitches and it wasn't a unified goal. And so I think I just removed it there. I'd say, who cares?
Yeah. But, it doesn't spoil the gameplay, but I'm sure there was some reviews picked up on that.
Maybe.
So essentially you were using quite a lot of the Amiga's hardware there. So was it a graphical rewrite? Was the base engine still the same underneath?
Fortunately, a lot of the computers at the time used the lovely 68000 processor, which was actually a pleasure to write hand code assembler on. It was a good good one for that. The majority of the code well, I recently reviewed it, so it's actually, yeah, it's surprising how small the kernel of the game actually is.
Yeah.
But the compared to the graphics systems and all the rest of it. But anyway, the gameplay translated over identically because it was using the same microprocessor.
Yeah.
And fortunately, my coding style, I was, and this had come because, you know, I'd already had 10 years experience of programming, so I had it sort of in a modular way, so okay. it was not too hard for me to port it over. I think I did the Amiga port in 6 weeks, and that was the first ever thing I did on the Amiga. You asked about the development environments.
Yeah.
And the Atari ST, I used the Aztec C68K C compiler. And this had in it a macro assembler. And so I used this Aztec C macro assembler for all of my 68,000 projects.
Okay.
And that was bundled with that on the ST was a thing called Gulam,
right.
Which was it was like a version of Emacs, the editor Emacs. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever heard
I've
of
heard
Emacs.
Of that, yeah.
Yeah. I developed the Amiga version on the ST.
Right.
And then had a parallel cable that I made myself that connected to the parallel ports. So the only thing I had to develop on the Amiga was the monitor, the program, that mm-hmm. it would just boot up. I didn't even use the normal Kickstart or whatever. I wrote my own bootloader.
Okay.
And it would just start up and then listen on the parallel port for instructions from the ST,
wow.
download the program and run it.
Yeah, I've heard of those environments reading about the old Commodore 64 days as well, where there would be some kind of connection to a very primitive PC at the time. So it's interesting to hear about that. So let's just come on to the physics. The side of the physics, like we said at the start, it was probably the first football game to remove that ball stuck to the foot feel. How in depth could you go with physics on a 68K platform on a 16-bit environment? Was it trimmed down to bare basics, or is it a physics model you could use nowadays quite easily?
Well, it's kind of interesting. If I was to do the game today, I would do a much better job than I would do then. And back then I was 22, so, and I'd had no training, so I'd only had my own, I trained myself, and my mathematical skills at that time were nowhere near as good as they are now.
Okay.
So it's actually the biggest constraint was, funnily enough, not the microprocessor still, it was me.
Mm.
So the physics model that I used was pretty simple. I used I use the terminology that I know now because I also teach this stuff, but I used a Euler integrator, so it's basically just adding velocity to position each time,
mm-hmm.
and then adding acceleration to the velocity for the gravity basically.
Yeah.
And then to do the air friction is just a force that's proportional to the velocity, so the faster the ball moves, you just take that velocity, divide it by a number, and
yeah.
subtract it from the current velocity. And so it's actually about, you know, a few lines of code in assembler and a few more because you write more lines.
Yeah, but you make it sound so simple.
But it is. That's the actual thing. It is incredibly simple. That's really it. For doing wind, you just, when you're calculating the air resistance,
yeah.
instead of just taking the current velocity, you take the velocity and add the wind. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then, and now you've created wind. So there's some tricks that, you know, stuff that's really, really simple. The AI in the system is also based on sort of rules, which are in essence also very simple. But I guess it all has to be very simple if you want it to run at 50 frames per
yeah.
second.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what wasn't simple was tuning. So I actually spent months and months tuning the game.
Okay.
This would involve me not even playing the game, but just for a long period of time, I just created the football simulation with it. You didn't even play. I just kept tuning the, you know, probably there were 100 or more tunable parameters in there. And just, it's like sculpting with numbers. And I just tweak it and I'd adjust the algorithms to the AI and try to get something that felt good. And then once that was done, then I added the control system for being able to play against it. Mm-hmm. But for very much the philosophy I picked at the time, and I still subscribe to this, is make the thing work great for itself and then add the player afterwards.
That's really very interesting, actually. Very interesting indeed. And for any of the listeners, you've got quite a few blog posts on the physics behind, well, physics behind the ball, haven't you?
Well, I've done, I have a four articles on my blog which concern sort of a little bit of research on my part on balls, you know, and the air friction, but nothing like that is inside Kickoff 2 or Goal.
No. Okay. Right. So, but if, yeah, if you're interested in physics, have a look at the blog. It's really quite interesting. It really interested me. I'm not good at maths at all. I'd love to get into it, but it's a little bit beyond me. Certainly what I was reading on there, but still really interesting to read though.
It is, yeah, it gets a little bit hairy with the old Lambert W function, but the thing about that is there's a story there. Even if you don't grasp the mathematics, there's a story, which is that there's this Lambert W function, see, and it's not available in maths libraries on computers. Yeah, it turns out to actually be incredibly important.
Right.
And it's, I find that's interesting, just how, you know, things can get missed out. Because if you do research into the Lambert W function, you actually find out that it appears everywhere. Mm. It's ubiquitous in nature, they say.
Oh, okay. Right.
And it's like, but you know, program, if you want to write something that uses it, you have to actually calculate the function yourself. You can't use the floating point processor of your CPU because it doesn't have it.
Yes.
On it, you know. I'm fascinated by stories like that.
That's very good. Well, I'll certainly look into that a little bit more so I have any idea of what you're on about there. So moving on from Kickoff 2, which again I'm assuming was a great commercial success, certainly critically very successful. And like I said earlier on, it's still played today by lots of people around the world, and these Kickoff 2 World Cups go on that are based in Milan, and there's a British one as well, isn't there?
There are actually national and international competitions, which seems incredible. The last international competition I actually attended, and I took part in the competition.
How did you do?
I came 32nd.
Out of?
40.
Okay.
I didn't come last. That was my mission. Good, yeah. Not come last. Because, yeah, these guys, they play the game an awful lot, and they run rings around me. Mm. But I hadn't played the game for 20 years,
yeah,
more or less. Yeah. So, but that's pretty awesome.
Actually. It is. It's not limited to Kickoff 2, just the whole retro culture of the way people are still playing these games, myself included, still playing these games 30, 20 years on, is just, it's great. I think it's good. It's good to keep that history alive, definitely. goal and the Mega Drive version, Dino Dini's Soccer, was this again your conception or was it produced for a purpose?
Well, goal was, by this point I had a career as a video game programmer. Well, more than that, a video game designer, creator, whatever. It was more, it was a different industry then. It was more like you were an author. You know, yeah. People wrote books or they could write video games. So, and after Kickoff 2, you know, as I said, I said, well, okay, I want to improve the game. There were things, when I looked at the game, I said, I want to try a new version of the game where I'm going to, you know, make it easier to pick up but still retain the depth and make the motion more realistic. So I made a list of things I wanted to do, and originally that was through Anko, and I think things were still pretty healthy then in terms of the creatively. I made another game. It was still a football game, but it was different and rewritten from scratch.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, for me personally, it's the culmination of the Kickoff series. It plays better than the rest, which surprises me that Kickoff 2 is the more popular one now. For me, Goal is better than Kickoff 1 and Kickoff 2, while still retaining essentially the same feel underneath. You know, the same basic feel is there with the way you control the ball, certainly against Kickoff 2 anyway. But it seems that I'm more in the minority than the rule there, which is a shame, because I believe it to be the best in the series personally.
Well, thank you. I don't know. I think I say thank you because I actually was quite proud of it. I know it's not perfect. There are certain things, like the auto kick seemed like the right thing to do. In retrospect, I should have made that an option.
I call it the cheat goal. Me and my brother still play it, as we spoke about at the Play Expo. And if we're losing badly, we might go for a couple of the easy goals, should we say.
Yeah, I think that's the reason, probably more than anything, why the game was not accepted. And it was a mistake not to have made it an option. I can't remember why it wasn't. I didn't make it an option. I really don't know what the thinking was there, but I know why I put it in originally, and it was simply that it was silly, in my view, that a player could be, you know, 2 feet away from the goal and miss.
Yeah. I think it's, while it's an easy way to get a goal, you've still got to put yourself in that position to get that goal. So I think it's the skill coming up to that point is what creates that goal, so you deserve that goal. And like you say, if you're that close to the goal, how can you miss?
And in fact, I designed the rest of the gameplay around that.
Okay.
So it wasn't just sort of added on as a kind of a cheap thing, because obviously it was potential for breaking the gameplay. And maybe that's the reason why I didn't make it an option. I designed it to be difficult to get to that position. That was, but maybe, you know, it was too easy in the end. I'm not sure. Or when people got really good at the game, they found it too easy. Mm. It's difficult to say. But the motion of the players, I was much happier with, and the AI was improved, and the tactical positioning things had improvement. There's a whole stream of things that I adjusted in that.
Yeah, so you had the players turning circle, didn't you, rather than just switching from forward to back or left to right.
Right.
The inertia of the players as well, which wasn't really in the Kickoff series or any other game to that point. So I personally think that's what alienated the sensible soccer fans and maybe some of the Kickoff 2 fans. The niceties to give it a slightly more realistic feel maybe ended up alienating those who preferred the twitch gameplay of the earlier games.
Well, having gone back to play Kickoff 2, which was an interesting experience to immerse myself in that game years later, and so now of course the designer in me comes out and says, "Ooh, did you really do that? And yeah. Ooh, what's that? And why did you never fix those missing pixels in the scanner?" And things like that. what? And I'm looking at it and going, "What?" But then after playing it a little bit, there's that initial thing. But then after playing it a little bit, then I realised, well, when you play the game for real, some of the glitches you don't see anymore. In fact, they don't happen because you're actually taking part in the game in the way it's meant to be played.
Yeah.
You know, I found that interesting. And sorry, I've kind of lost track of what the question was again.
It was just about the touches, and do you think that's what alienated should we say, the sensible soccer fans and the Kickoff 2 fans?
So where I was going with that was that I noticed that when I'm watching other people play, there is one thing that really annoys me playing that game that I tried to fix with goal, which is to do with the inertia. The purpose of the inertia was not to actually make the game less controllable, but to provide a way that you could have a choice between going fast and having the ball move away from you, or to actually go at a slower speed in between and not lose the ball.
Yeah.
And in Kickoff 2, it's very, very hard to just move a little distance and still keep the ball.
Yeah, because you're at full speed straight away, aren't you?
You're at full speed straight away. In fact, there is a technique you can use where you just, push forward and let go of the button. No, let go of the button first and then push forward and then immediately hold the button so that you trap the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And then do the same again, but you have to do it in exactly the right order. Otherwise, it goes and kicks the ball away.
Yeah.
And so, but the thing is that by the time Goal came out, the ones that really loved my game, but loved Kickoff 2, had all become experts of the game and all its little quirks. That's the word I was looking for, yeah. All its little quirks. And then that incorporated that into their gameplay. Mm. And so this is the dilemma. I actually think I created overall a better game.
Yeah.
But people had already created a play style adapted to the previous one.
Yeah.
And these days, actually, people say, you should go and release a new game. And I'm thinking, yeah, okay, well, I could try this, and I think about it, and this is a whole other story. Now, as I said to her, I was interviewed at the World Cup competition. Mm. I said, these guys here, they're lovely, and they honour me with the fact they still play the game and so on, but if I'm to release a new game, they're not my customers for that.
No.
You see my point? They might be spokespeople for it. They might help sort of spread the word about it.
Yeah.
But in the end, they're happy with the thing that they love and this relationship they built up with that.
That's a very good point. Yeah, it is. So what happened with Anko and the move to Virgin?
I think Anko, Anil, one day, he actually told me about, I can't remember exact details here, this other company that was called Sensible Software had approached Anko. And I was kind of it might have been something else. There was some connection anyway, whatever it was. It's all a long time ago. But the basic story is that I was a bit upset about hearing this. And so I said to Anil, what about loyalty? And Anil Gupta replied, I don't owe you any loyalty.
Right.
And maybe he was just saying that because it's the business thing to say.
Mm.
However, it was totally the wrong thing to say to me. On a certain level, I like things to be fair. I believe in fairness. I believe that we should all be conducting ourselves in a way that, the quid pro quo, whatever, I don't know. Mm-hmm. If somebody says to me something like that, then I go, what?
Yeah.
So it means if Anil Gupta felt that he owed no loyalty to me, then I owe no loyalty to him.
Yeah. So kind of treat one as you expect to be treated yourself, almost.
Yeah. It kind of then set the ball in motion in my mind that I needed to find another publisher.
Yeah.
That's it. It was simple as that. And so after a long story and other things and decisions made, and some of them that were maybe, I don't know if it was the right decision in the end, but I went with Virgin.
Yeah. And I assume it was them that got the sponsorship with Adidas as well.
Yes. They got for the, I can't remember which game. Maybe it was all of them. I don't know. Mm. But there was some. In fact, you mentioned Predator. There was actually a move to have the Predator license.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That was the story with Dino Dini Soccer.
So, yeah, on to Dino Dini Soccer. The change of name was because it was on the Mega Drive, and that was kind of more of the naming convention the target audience wanted?
No, it's got to do with the fact that we were trying to get a deal with for the Predator, so it would could have been called Predator Soccer.
Okay.
That fell through. You know, it could have been called Goal, except that there was already a game called Goal. So it was a bit of a screw-up, which was Jaylico had a game called Goal.
Yes, yes.
And so they didn't know what to call it. And so I said, well, call it Dino Dini Soccer. And they said, yes. That's how that came about.
Was it well-received on the Mega Drive? I've not read any reviews of it. For me, I've played it, and it feels... I mean, it feels brilliant. It feels like a, you know, an even more polished version of Goal. I'm not a fan of more than one button, though. Admittedly, I love the one joystick button that does everything. But it feels even more polished. Was it well received? Because it was at the time when FIFA probably just come about in '94, wasn't it?
Well, this is the thing. The story about that. First of all, a word of warning: if anybody wants to play Dino Dini Soccer on the Mega Drive on an emulator, you need to make sure that either emulator doesn't have the CMOS RAM all zeroed out, or you need to get hold of, if it's still around,
your
a fix.
Updated version.
I made a fix some 10 years ago.
Mm.
If you get that wrong, you play the game, there was a bug in the original version that was released where if the CMOS RAM 4 bytes in or 6 bytes in there happened to be all zero, which was very unlikely, so it never really happened. But in the emulators, they're always zero, because that's not the default for memory. Mm. So then all the random rolls in the game remain zero, and this has the effect of completely destroying the gameplay.
Ah,
it's like you play the game with dice that always roll sixes, you know? Mm. So the referee always gives a red card, the players always tackle. If you've seen anything like, I don't, you know, maybe that happened to you. I don't know if you used an updated version or whatever. So, word of warning.
I used your updated version. Okay. That's quite an interesting game mechanic, actually. That could be used to quite good fun, I think. Sort of as a party game, almost, with the errors in it. That's
okay, yeah. So we're going to play Dino Didi Soccer with CMOS RAM bug. Turn on, but I got an option.
Did you tweak that version at all? Because there was the online client, wasn't there, on those Mega Drive emulators at the time. I think it might even still be integrated into it. Did you tweak it for that as well?
Yes, I did. There was a version that was tweaked because I'd restored the complete dev environment of Goal. I was able to do that. And this was around about 2002 or so. I actually added features to it to facilitate that online play. And it did play quite well online.
It did. I had about 2 games on it, and it was a little bit laggy, probably down to the broadband connection at the time. But it was good fun. Even that lag... It almost added another gameplay element to it as well. Which
I think it was good, and it was an experiment, and it was a complete failure because I don't think we ever had playing online more than, I think that the total number of regular players on there never reached more than about 15. Okay. And so that was like a big demotivator to do any to try anything else, because it's like, hey people, here's a version of Goal you can play online. It's like, come on, it's free. There's nobody here. So, but I did do that. The point is that Dino Dini Soccer, after all the work that went into doing that and all the rest of it, got released on the same day as FIFA in '94.
Okay.
And that was basically the end of my career. Cut a long story short.
Wow. Okay.
So I'd gone from success in 1989... So I had about a 5-year period where I was riding the wave and then crashed. That's
unfortunate. I assume that was a Virgin decision to release it at that time.
I don't know. I'm not sure what the logic was behind it. It could have been bad luck. I was also not the easiest person to get on with at that time. Could be that I pissed people off there at Virgin. I was still a kid. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm sure that in the end it was just one of those things. Because your question, as I now remember the question you asked me, was, you know, was it well received? And the point is, having been released on the same day as FIFA, it got virtually no coverage at all.
Unfortunate flop almost, really, isn't it?
Yeah, although the game was good. I mean, I think it was the probably out of all the platforms and so on, that's leaving aside some of the quirks of the Mega Drive, you know, but it was probably the best version of them all.
Yeah, what was the Mega Drive like to develop for compared to the Amiga and the ST?
Well, it was quite pleasant on a certain level, but, you know, I got hold of the Mega Drive and bought an EEPROM emulator and just plugged it in and just went away at it. And the actual graphics engine for drawing the pitch and the sprites was quite sophisticated, and I made full use of the hardware. There's DMA downloading of the graphics into VRAM, because VRAM wasn't big enough to hold it all. So okay. There were some challenges I had to do, but in 7 weeks I ported that over, and even managed to do on the fly recoloring of the sprites so that I could have players with light and dark skin.
Yeah, and there was, I think, the stripes on there.
There was stripy kits. Some of those things came from the fact that I was able to go from 8 color graphics to 16 color.
Yeah, okay.
On the Mega Drive.
Yeah.
But the real pain with the Mega Drive was the fact that it didn't have a raster screen. You didn't have a bitmap that you could draw to.
Okay.
So that's why the menus on Dino Dini Soccer are kind of weird and very different from the Amiga. Mm. It's because it wasn't possible to just draw to the screen.
Dino Dini Soccer. It's in the name.
Sound effects on the Mega Drive, because I know it's got the FM chip in it, and it's always been a bugbear for me, the Mega Drive sound compared to, because I'm a big Amiga fan, and obviously Amiga was very sample based, whereas the Mega Drive is very synthesis based. Did you get involved with that, or was that done by someone separate?
That was done by a separate company and separate people that Virgin contracted to do it. And so it was that usual thing. They give you a module, you're supposed to call this thing, and once every frame or whatever, and that's it, and it plays the music, and that was that. And then the sound effects were, I can't remember, to be honest, but it's just, you know, usual thing, put sound effects in, so on. Well, there is a story in that, which is that I was really keen to have the music change during play. So they'd made this piece of music, and I just kept hearing it. You know, that there was a part of the music which sounded a certain way, and I said, that would be perfect for when the ball goes over the sideline. Okay. So whatever's playing at that time, just cut it.
Yeah.
And that's the way that system actually works. It does that. And I think it works really well. It's just,
so you're dynamically changing the music on the fly.
Yeah, exactly. By picking certain points to jump to, and then of course the transition is just—it's just cuts to it. The thing was is that the people who supplied the thing, I asked them about this, and they went, "Oh no, oh no, oh no, you can't do that. No, 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 no." And I was thinking, why can't I do that? It's an easy thing to do, you know. And it's like, can't you just give me access? Can't I just change the point of the playing in the music? And they were very uncooperative, so I hacked it. I took their driver. I worked out where the analysing what was going on. I didn't have the source code. And then I worked out where the bytes were that corresponded to the current piece of the music that was being played and figured out from there what to do. And I just basically poked these values in to change the music. And it was not something that they would have approved of, but it made it do what I wanted it to do.
No, I guess they got their money and that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that's the end of part one of the Dino Denny interview. Hope you enjoyed it so far. We've covered a lot of ground. We've covered a lot of ground in that first half. Kickoff two. Goal, Dino Denny, soccer, pre-kickoff. Everything's in there and you wouldn't think there was a lot more, but there definitely is a part two. And just to give you a taster of exactly what's coming up in part two, and I'll tell you what, you are not going to be able to contain yourself and wait for part two after this little clip.
Ooh, I hear something starting up. Was that your end or my end? Whose end was that?
That's not mine. That's a Windows machine, isn't it? That's...
Yeah, then it's my... I have a laptop. Sorry about that. I couldn't tell with these headphones on where it was coming from.
I mean, what more could you want? Really, what more could you want? Anyway, like I said, thank you for listening. You have been in tune to Matt Denaris on the Retro Asylum podcast. Again, we love your iTunes reviews. Get yourself on there. Note down some great thoughts on this podcast, or even not so great thoughts. So, you know, we're all welcome to constructive feedback and so on. Shout out to Andy, Dean Swain, Glenn, Foggy, Mr. Sid, Damien, Darren, all the Retro Asylum crew. If I missed anyone, I do apologise. To the forum, you're keeping the thing lively and it's really, really nice to see. Every day I come on there, a load of new posts, a load of new great thoughts and great opinions on retro gaming. It's really great to see. The site is really beginning to come alive massively now. And also don't forget the Retro Revival event up there at in Wolverhampton on the 18th and 19th of May. We're all hoping to be there. I'm not looking 100% at the moment, but I know the rest of the gang are certainly going to be descending on that place. And big shout out to Chris Wilkins of Retro Fusion and Retro Revival. Anyway, I'm out of here. Thanks again for listening.